Welcome to episode 165 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my guest is Jonathan Hertzberg, the founder of the great boutique label Fun City Editions. Joining me from New York City, Jonathan, welcome to Junk Filter.
Jesse, thank you so much for having me.
Our subject for today is the label's new release, 1983's Deep in the Heart, aka Handgun, directed by Tony Garnett. This film is a great example of the kind of films that Fun City Editions specializes in. Reissues of forgotten and overlooked treasures, or works that exist outside of their time. These are also the kinds of movies that I love to bring to the attention of my listeners. And I'm thrilled, Jonathan, that this movie is finally getting a release on disc. I think this is the first time it's been out on disc.
It's the first time it's out on Blu-ray. There have been some DVDs, but yeah. I'm thrilled that you're thrilled. I'm hoping that there are a few more like you that are also thrilled and respond with, you know, with a purchase.
I'm going to try to sell you some Blu-rays, Jonathan.
Doing these types of films is a labor of love, but I, you know, I can use as much championing from people like you as I can get, because these are a more difficult sell, obviously, than the more explicitly genre films, the horror stuff, obviously, and that's why there's so much more of that out there.
Well, this is a very difficult film to watch. We should say that right off the bat.
Yes.
It's a movie that made an impression on me. I think I saw this for the first time on City TV in the late 80s. I can't quite remember the context for seeing this movie. I used to also rent movies all the time at video stores like Suspect, which specialized in getting, you know, everything cult related. And this movie certainly has a sort of cult audience. And I never forgot the memorable VHS case for this movie from Thorn EMI Home Video, which you've paid tribute to on the packaging of this release.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that is a rather striking piece of artwork. And I don't remember where I first saw the film or the art. I probably saw this box in the video store, but I didn't see it till later, and I did not catch it. I did not catch it on late night TV, like you did. But it definitely was a film I think I had shortlisted for a while as something that would be, you know, a good fit for us, and that would, you know, that would fit right in with a lot of the other films that we've released that have seemed to be neglected. They're of a certain age, and they sort of feel like they're in between in an in between space in terms of like this film having genre elements, but also having other elements that sort of, you know, take it out of that space. So that's part of what makes some of these films a harder sell, because they're not comfortably just, you know, one thing or two things. And I think this film is definitely, you know, more than one or two things. It gets categorized a lot as a rape revenge film, but obviously, you know, that doesn't tell the whole story.
You can't possibly begin to understand history down here unless you know something about Colt revolvers.
Well, how come you come to know so much? They teach you this at law school?
I collect antique guns.
I wouldn't mind going out with him occasionally and having a good time. There's nothing wrong with that, is there?
This could have been a love story. It turns into a nightmare when this woman becomes a victim of an attack.
Junk Filter has done episodes on a few of the films that Fun City Editions has released. We did a show with Dan Beckner on Cutter's Way, and we did a show with Aaron and Carly from Hit Factory on Breathless. But I've also had long digressions on other episodes about some of your other releases, including Herbert Ross's T.R. Baskin and Bobby Roth's Heartbreakers. I should say right off the bat that, like, you guys are doing heroic work. And I'm one of these people that starts doing handsprings when I see what you're putting out.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Oh my God, they're putting out The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz. They're putting out a box set of TV movies, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, you're our target audience. You get it. It's definitely, I will say, I didn't really have a strong game plan or template, as it were. It really was guided by my, you know, feelings for, you know, again, for these kind of under the radar films that felt deserving of more love, and which, when they have been seen by people like you, they do engender that kind of feeling. Discovered, not rediscovered, but really discovered for the first time by audiences that had no idea that they existed before. And a lot of that was just because they were really quite often out of circulation, you know, really not officially available for quite some time.
The other feeling that I get sometimes from some of the films that you've put out is that it's like the correction of some kind of cultural injustice. That why did it take this long for Cutter's Way to get released on Blu-ray, for instance, or, you know, T.R. Basket. Like, yeah. When you watch this movie, you see how influential it was on later films. Like, while I was watching T.R. Baskin, I was thinking, yeah, God, so much of the Fifth and a Half Floor from Being John Malkovich seems to come from T.R. Baskin.
See, that's been so long since I've watched that film that I'm not totally getting your reference there, but
T.R. Baskin is about this woman who's being sort of depersonalized when she moves from the Midwest, small town Midwest, to Chicago, and gets a job in sort of this typing pool at this company where you don't even know what they do.
It's true.
But she seems to be getting in trouble a lot for not doing it right. And, you know, it's just adding to her sadness.
It is. And another thing that struck me when I watched those scenes in T.R. Baskin was that even though this is not a science fiction film, and Peter Hyams, who wrote and produced the film, obviously has gone on to be very well known for his science fiction output, not exclusively, but you know, things like Outland and Capricorn One and probably a couple others I'm forgetting right now, 2010. I felt like those scenes kind of had like a futuristic sort of in some way kind of foreshadowed that he would be working in science fiction in the near future.
To blow your mind, Jonathan, Peter Boyle's character in T.R. Baskin mentions that he works for Con Amalgamate, which is the evil corporation from Outland.
That's right. That's right. And I saw that recently somewhere. I think I saw it somewhere on Twitter. Maybe it was you. Somebody posted
probably
that.
Me, actually.
Yeah, because I was like, oh, wow, that's some great – little inside baseball there that completely, even though I'm a big fan of Outland, it had not occurred to me. So yeah, that's a fun little, Hyams universe, shout out there. But what you're saying, actually, when you connect one of these films to something that came later and, or that is better known by the general audience, that is certainly something that I've had in mind in terms of, well, how do I justify this release? How do I make it relevant to an audience now? And a great way to do that is to say, well, if you like this, or if you know, or you can see the seeds of this in T.R. Baskin, for instance, you know, you can see where this possibly, you know, being John Malkovich, maybe the filmmaker did see T.R. Baskin. Maybe it's not just a coincidence that you're seeing, you know, a similarity there.
Yeah. Or another film that you guys put out was Bobby Roth's Heartbreakers, which is a personal favorite of mine, and a movie that I was like frustrated that I couldn't find it anywhere. Like, the best that I could do was to find a crappy transfer of the VHS that somebody uploaded to YouTube. Yeah. But like, why is a movie that stars Peter Coyote, that was shot by Michael Ballhaus, that was scored by Tangerine Dream, why is this movie so hard to see?
I know. And sometimes there really is no good answer, except like the bean counters at the studio just didn't, you know, see the value in it. We don't really know. A lot of times people want to cite something like music, but it's not always that. Sometimes it's a lot more banal. So I don't really know with Heartbreakers, and neither did Bobby Roth, for that matter, in our conversations. But I can tell you, I mean, he was so thrilled and so appreciative that the film was finally getting, you know, getting a remaster, getting back out there. I wish we could do more with it in terms of making it available streaming and do more theatrical with it and stuff like that. But with those studio films, usually the only rights that we're able to license are the packaged media, the home video. So that's why Heartbreakers is still not, as far as I know, it's still not streaming anywhere. I mean, that's up to the studio to do. So if you want to see it in a decent version legally, you have to buy our Blu-ray.
Please tell my listeners about the history of Fun City Editions. How did this company get created?
Well, I've worked in film distribution for quite a few years, mostly on the theatrical side. Before I was in distribution, I worked in programming films in when I was in college and in graduate school, and then eventually through kind of a convoluted process as these things often go, I ended up in distribution and working for various art house independent distributors in the New York area. And gradually, I started to specialize more in repertory, classic reissues of classic films, and also just kind of managing the back catalog. Most recently, before Fun City, at a company called Kino Lorber. I always wanted to do more in video and in publishing because I've always been a collector. But when I was at companies like Kino, they have a very robust video program, and there's good people, already in those jobs. So, but I had gained a lot of knowledge about the whole, process of licensing films and restoration, the reissue, the packaging, and the marketing through my work, but also as a collector, as a consumer as well. And that's something that just sort of spoke to me, and something I felt like I did see a space there. I did see titles like Heartbreakers and Deep in the Heart. I start counting. I did feel like some of these films were still slipping through the cracks, even though there were so many other great boutique labels out there. And there continues to be, a great amount of product coming out. But I did feel like some of these titles that, like I said, weren't quite comfortably in one space or another, were still lacking, the platform. That's how Fun City Editions came into being. But a lot of it has evolved, and a lot of it's happened, on the fly. Stumbling on these movies, it happens differently now because we don't have finding things off a video shelf, in person, or stumbling on things late at night on TV so much anymore. That's not how the discoveries are happening. But I do kind of endeavor to have something similar with Fun City, that these are these movies. Like a Heartbreakers that kind of just, they just really hit you when you're not expecting it. I still get when I have that experience, and I'm sure you do as well, with something, a film that I wasn't aware of before, didn't have any expectations, and it just hits you, in a way where it's for me, as far as a cinephile, cinema watcher, that's the greatest high. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I hope that I am able to help make that happen for people with, more people with something like Heartbreakers. Because it was that way for me, like it was for you when I saw it. Why isn't this better known? Like, why isn't this easier to see? It should be.
Yeah, like one of the heroic things that you guys put out was this obscure movie called Born to Win. Mm-hmm. Directed by Yvonne Passer, who also went on to make Cutter's Way, a movie that I knew mostly because of public domain crappy VHS. And it was like, if you went to a dollar store, there'd be like 35 copies of Born to Win because Robert De Niro was in it.
Yeah.
And I remember when I finally saw, I think it was on Amazon Prime in an okay transfer, and I was stunned at what an incredible time capsule the movie was of mm-hmm. New York City. And Fun City Editions is named after a nickname that New York had around that time.
Yes, yes. And that movie is, and that movie may possibly be the most Fun City, literally Fun City movie in the collection. Because, as you said, it is in New York. It is shot in New York in 1970, and that is the prime Fun City era of New York. It was an ironic nickname, you know, for the city in a period of decline. Born to Win is a good example of that. Was a movie where, for whatever reason, it was treated as a public domain film. You saw it in all these terrible bootleg iterations. Everything, all the sources for that transfer that you saw are from a cut TV version of the film. So it's not even like, it wasn't even the full, like, full strength R-rated version of Born to Win. And I don't know why that happened. And I do know that, you know, it's not the only film that's happened with. It probably, like you said, had something to do with Robert De Niro being in it. And then, you know, if the rights holder doesn't you know, kind of clamp down on that stuff, then they just proliferate. And there's just certain movies that you just saw over and over again, like you said, in like in the supermarket or something, in like dollar, you know, iterations with like a picture of Robert De Niro from a completely different era, you know, as if he's starring in the film. And it was like a 1987 film or something instead of a 1971 film. Yeah. If you're going by the the bootleg box art,
yeah, the bootleg box art has that sort of graphic design is my passion energy. Like, it looks ugly, wouldn't know from looking at the case that it's actually a very remarkable and very bleak character study.
Yeah,
that doesn't directly involve De Niro anyway.
No, he's quite good in it, but you know, yeah, he's certainly peripheral. But I'm happy that, you know, we have a movie that we could say in the catalog somewhere we have a De Niro, and we, you know, and I'm happy that we have an Ivan Passer, not just one but two Ivan Passers, because we have Born to Win and Cutter's Way, and it's nice to be able to like check that box off, be like, yeah, we have a De Niro. And it's actually a good, you know, it's actually a good one. It's just one that you might not have seen.
But you guys have also been recently releasing these incredible French 80s sleaze movies. If you could tell my listeners a little bit about this ongoing project.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, well, it kind of occurred to me that, you know, as the catalog grew a little bit, you know, not just to me, but other people pointed it out that there were a lot of films that, even though they weren't necessarily New York, literally New York Fun City films, that we have other films like T.R. Baskin, which is set in another metropolis, Chicago in that case, but it's the same time period. And the cities, a lot of cities were experiencing similar, similar issues that New York was famously facing in that time in the late 60s and into the 70s, you know, white flight and, you know, lack of or loss of resources, vital resources in the city, which of course contributed to the decrepitness that you saw happening. And so the Paris films, these films that we've released that are set in Paris, in Fun City Paris, as it were, or neon sleaze Paris, you know, just kind of, you know, there's a through line there. There are films that are in a, you know, kind of existing in a criminal environment. They're either crime films or crime adjacent films. And I felt like that's such a popular, such a huge part of French cinema, especially, for decades, if not the century. But those films, for whatever reason, have not really been seen outside of France. Especially these films from the 70s and the 80s, even though the crime film was so popular in France at the time, and all the top actors were in these films. And so you have in this upcoming set, we have called Seeing Red, which are kind of like post-Death Wish vigilante thrillers, and they all star like top of the line actors in France at the time, you know, actors that were, you know, regularly nominated for César awards and such. And so it's just interesting to see that they're sort of influenced by American, you know, by genre films like A Death Wish, but then they're, you know, a little more nuanced, and there's more melodrama and more, maybe more of a political message that you don't have in the American, in the American films. They're not quite as easily categorized to say exploitation. There's a certain quality to them.
So what is the process for Fun City Edition to acquire titles? Do you have like a little list of the things you'd like to release someday? And then you start, you know, going around seeing how real you can make it?
Yeah, certainly there are, you make individual lists that are connected to certain rights holders, you know, or to certain studios or sales companies. A lot of times people don't realize that, especially when they suggest titles, say for a TV movie set, that, you know, they'll be like, why don't you do this, this, and this together? And they're like three films from three different rights holders, right?
Right.
And that's kind of like not really how it works. Like, it would be very difficult or impossible to do that. You kind of have to find a rights holder, and you have to put a package together. You can't just cherry pick one title from this person and that place and one from there, unless you're dealing directly with a filmmaker where they control the film. That's a little bit different. But so anyway, in a roundabout way, it's another convoluted process. I don't have a master list that I go down. It's more like, okay, I can do something. I can possibly do a deal with this rights holder, and now let me go hone in on what they have in that catalog and try to come out with, with a little package that makes sense for us. So like the French titles, for instance, as well as Deep in the Heart, Handgun, those came from Studio Canal, huge catalog, like thousands of, I mean, they just gobble up many different catalogs over the years. So they have now, you know, films from not just from France, from all over, all different eras. And it takes a long time to go through that. You know, the spreadsheet has so many different columns, and you kind of sort them in a lot of different ways to try to turn over, make sure you don't leave a stone unturned. Mm-hmm. And I was like thinking when I was going through the catalog of like things that kind of had been neglected. And I felt like, for instance, a lot of these 80s French crime films had been kind of neglected. We had seen a lot of films from the earlier generation. We've seen Belmondo, and we've seen Delon, and we've seen Gabin, but we hadn't seen Bernard Giraudot or Gerard Lanvin, like the stars of our films in the Seeing Red collection, for instance. So I started seeing that there were these films existed, and they had, and I was, you know, kind of like, oh, if I package these together, I think it would be, you know, tough to release these on their own. But if I can find a few titles that I can creatively package, as we did with, with the Fatal Fom set or the Seeing Red collection, I feel like that makes it a more palpable, more feasible thing. And that's just with one rights holder. You know, you're just going through that catalog with a fine tooth comb. And again, I'm not exaggerating when I say there's thousands of films in that catalog. So, you know, there's any number of fun, equally fun creative sets that could come out of that, for instance.
It's the perfect way to combine TV movies. And one thing that I also really respect about Fun City Editions is that you will devote time and energy and effort into reintroducing the TV movie, which I feel is a lost art.
Yeah, it is like one of the final frontiers, maybe of physical media. But it's tough because so all the TV movies we've released, all those have come from like one rights holder. So there's a lot of stuff I would love to do, and people make lots of great suggestions. And again, it's just that it comes down to who controls those films, and really you kind of have to find several that you can get from one rights holder, and you have to have decent materials to do a decent restoration, And, you know, there's a lot of pieces that have to come together. It's kind of an amazing thing with those films because, as we've noted in our previous releases, the two Primetime Panic sets, these films were seen in their initial like airing by potentially millions of people, right? Like more people than saw a lot of the films we've released. But then they kind of just disappear, or they don't disappear. They might, you know, appear in syndication over the years, but their video life, you know, a lot of it, they never had a video life. They were culturally treated as sort of discardable, like as like, this is a thing for the moment. Like you watch, you know, this is for like Thursday night at 9 p.m. on this date. And then after that, it's on to the next one. I mean, and they were so prolifically made. Yeah, it's fun to put those back out there and talk about that and place those and give people don't realize, especially people from younger generations, I don't think realize how ubiquitous these things were. And then how quickly that dissipates. And then, so now you get to decades later and nobody knows what Incident at Crest Ridge is.
Jonathan, have you ever heard of a TV movie called Missing Pieces?
No, not off the top of my head. No. Mm-mm. Can you tell me about it?
It's a movie that I stumbled across because City TV showed it as their 1 o'clock afternoon movie. And it's this 1983 TV movie directed by Mike Hodges.
Okay.
Starring Elizabeth Montgomery as a woman whose husband is murdered, and she plays detective to try and solve his murder. And it's really arty and stylish and almost avant-garde, even though it's also very normy and TV movie-ish. And it's a movie that I finally was able to bug somebody who has torrenting powers to find it for me. But I didn't know if you've ever heard of it. Not that I'm asking you to put it out necessarily, but you should see it sometime.
That's from 1983, huh?
Yeah. But I think you'll be surprised at how stylish and strange it is as a TV movie.
Well, I'm really not surprised by it at this point because, you know, I feel like for as many of those films do kind of feel boilerplate or have a lot of boilerplate elements, they do often manage to sneak in aspects that are surprisingly arty or surprisingly not mainstream. So it doesn't surprise me. And you mentioned, you know, somebody like Mike Hodges being involved. And that's another thing that is interesting about those TV movies is how often this, we think of a divide between film and TV. You know, like if you worked in film, you know, you were working in film, you weren't working in TV and vice versa. But then, you know, all of the films we released have people in front of and behind the camera who were, you know, prominently also in, you know, in feature films. So that's something that I think will continue to, you know, that myth or what have you, you know, as more of these come out again. Or become more available, even on streaming. There are a lot of these TV films available in, you know, various quality masters on the different streaming services. And sometimes they're remastered if it's a TV movie that a studio controls. It's funny, you get to see some of these films in a, you know, similar quality to what the Primetime Panic ones looked like, which is to say better than they ever looked when they were on TV originally. I'm curious. I'm looking the movie up you just mentioned, Missing Pieces. So if I go to, I'm on IMDb and I go to company credits and well, it looks like ITC Entertainment. That's a major, ITC is a major company. So they're one of the production companies. So.
Yeah. Well, maybe it got a more prominent airing in the UK because of the pedigree of the director. But yeah, it's just such a strange film to have been just put on the Tuesday night movie on CBS.
They were so prolific. That's the thing. They were making so many of these movies. You know, somebody who's more of a TV movie scholar could give you the stats, but it's like every week there's multiple TV movies on one network alone. So there's just so much need for there was so much need for this product that it doesn't surprise me that there's weird, these movies that seem kind of like anomalies that would show up because they had slots to fill, and they did churn them out quickly. They did really, I talked to Jonathan Kaplan when we released his film Death Ride to Osaka, also known as Girls of the White Orchid. And he did like four TV. This was after Over the Edge had been had such a complicated and kind of aborted release. And he was kind of like in, as they like to say now, in director jail. And that's why he did all these TV movies. But he said they really taught him a lot about how to work more efficiently and kind of work with limited means, and really helped him with, when he started making features again after that. They were made like super, super quickly. You had to be on your game. I'm curious about this one now, though. Certainly made me curious.
Yeah. It's like, it's the kind of thing that, if not you, who will?
Well, again, it would be like I have to. So I look at it and I say, what I just did now, looking at going on IMDb, company credits is like one of the places you kind of have to start. You got to say like, oh, who produced this, and then click on their credits and see, well, what else is there? Because there's a chance that maybe something else that's in this same package of films has been released already. Or, and that can give you an idea of like, well, who, from who, via who, is it available from, possibly. Or it gives you like, oh, I could see there's a few other movies within this collection, within this package here, that could be maybe packaged together. You know, that's what happened with the Primetime Panic. Like I was looking through a catalog of, a large catalog of TV movies, and like the first set, it just turned out that, well, actually both sets are films like they're all films from like one producer or executive producer, one production company basically. But then I kind of had to go through and cherry pick the films within that grouping that I thought maybe could go together. Mm-hmm. I thought we did a better job of it I feel like the Primetime Panic, the first one, has some nice connectivity there in terms of all the films being like dealing with young people. And that's something that I'm always drawn to, coming of age stories, stories that are, about young, people in that sort of young adult age grouping. And that's something we had with Primetime Panic 1. But again, it just came down to what was in that grouping that, made it would be possible to put together in a set.
This man is in serious trouble, spiritually, emotionally, and he's going to be in great legal trouble.
I want him punished.
This guy is a respectable, professional man with no criminal record. Look, Kathleen, even if you did get it into court, the defense would rip you to pieces.
She said no. And she meant it.
Let's begin talking a little about Deep in the Heart. I'd be interested to find out your relationship to this movie. Like, how did you find out about this?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I was trying to remember from before I went on with you. I was trying to piece that together. And I feel like I said, I think I'd seen the video art maybe in the store back in the day. Those Thorny MI tapes certainly stood out. And I also probably also had read about it in one of the several books that I would reference. It could have been in, any number of my go-to film tomes back then. Where I might have seen it, written up, but I don't think I watched it until sometime in the DVD era, early 2000s. There was an Anchor Bay DVD of it, I think, and that may be where I first saw it. But I don't remember. I just know that I knew it was I knew it was in the, that it was a Studio Canal title. So it was a title for a while that I had in mind, you know, if I was going to do some business with Studio Canal.
It was directed by Tony Garnett, who I know as the guy who produced all of the Ken Loach films. Garnett commissioned a lot of films for the BBC in the 60s and worked a lot with Ken Loach. But then in the late 70s and the early 80s, Garnett did this strange move where he went over to Los Angeles to try to make films in the US. And so Deep in the Heart is a film about gun culture and it's a rape and revenge drama, but from an outsider's perspective. And one of the films that it reminded me of while I was watching it was Werner Herzog's Strozek. That it was a film set in America, but from an outsider's point of view. And it was sort of looking at American life almost as if an alien landing on the planet Earth would look at American life. He's trying to understand gun culture. I guess it was sort of marketed as a sort of exploitation film, but it's not all that exploitative.
No, I think it was, I mean, that was part of the trouble. It was a hard film to market, and it was marketed differently. Obviously, it had even two different titles in, you know, English speaking territories, being Handgun being the original title in the UK. And then in the US, it was called Deep in the Heart. And that was, as from what I understand from reading an interview with Garnett at the time, it was, you know, after the film was, you know, I guess shown to focus groups and, you know, going through the process, the distribution process, even trying to sell the film, it was thought that Handgun was too associated, that the title made people immediately associate it as like a Charles Bronson film. You know, it was immediately in America, I guess, that was the fear was that the audience, they were going to lose, like, say, a female audience that they wanted to capture with the film, but who would be put off by the title. So that's part of like how Deep in the Heart, you know, ended up being the title that it was barely released under in this country.
Yeah, we'll get into that shortly. It was filmed on location in Dallas, and we see Dealey Plaza fairly early on in the movie.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
And we also see that Kathleen, the main character, has the John Lennon double fantasy album cover up in her. Her apartment, like
lots of not accidental visual cues here.
I want to read you a really funny, cranky review of this movie that I found on Amazon while I was getting ready to do this show. I will not say who said this, but this was their comment. I want to hear your response. Tony Garnett, a British leftist suffering from Stockholm syndrome vis-a-vis his own tyrannical government, and therefore craves the oppression that occurs when denied access to firearms, was apparently quote-unquote fascinated with America's quote-unquote love of guns. As a result, he hopped across the pond to make a movie chastising us for it. I saw this on cable back in the 80s, and I thought it was average at best.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. I actually saw that. I did see that review. I can't remember if it was on Letterboxd or
it was on Amazon.
It was on Amazon. Okay. Yeah, I did see that. And I cracked up. Like, just like I started laughing as you read it now. Yeah.
Sounds like it. I think it touched a nerve with this person.
It sure does. But, you know, I actually feel like, and again, perhaps, because I'm not in any of those groups that are depicted in the film. So, even though I'm an American, I am an outsider to the world, the specific world and milieu that this film takes place in. And I mean, I'm more like Kathleen coming from the Northeast. So when I watch it, I'm kind of struck by the way it makes the points that it makes. I don't feel like I'm being beat over the head so much. I feel like there's a real kind of matter of factness about like the scenes, those sort of pseudo interview scenes that you have with the gun nut characters, like especially in that scene in the restaurant with the guy with the knife.
Yeah.
Like there's something about it where it just feels like, oh, he just put the camera on the guy and let him talk, you know?
Mm-hmm. But this is what I recognize from the work that Garnett did with Ken Loach, the social realist approach. That's it's like a British way of covering life as it is lived, except with the lens now focused on American life. So there are a lot of non-professional actors who actually are pretty good in this movie.
Yeah.
All the scenes where she's sort of getting indoctrinated into the gun culture, those are real guys. And
That guy's great. The guy who plays the who's the actor who is teaching her, you know, who's her gun instructor, he was on the crew of the film. Yeah, I don't know if he was an editor or he had another role though. And then he's just totally believable in that part, you know, performing that part. He just also happened to be, he happened to have that gun knowledge. And I think that Garnett talked about going, I think he's the guy in one of the interviews, it might even be on the disc, the archival interview with Garnett from the time where he says he went to one of his crew members' homes. And he said it was like the guy could have like, you know, armed us, you know, he could have supported a small army with all the guns in his house. And I believe that's the guy. I think that's the same guy who plays the gun and the instructor. And he, like I said, he's really good. He's not portrayed unsympathetically in the film either. I don't think. Seems like a nice enough guy. He just, you know, happens to love guns.
To start our conversation off, I just want to single out the central performance by the actor Karen Young, one of my very favorite performers. I love her in everything.
And this is her screen debut.
Yeah.
Like, she's never acted in front of the camera before, as far as I know.
She's galvanizing in this movie. The first time I ever saw Karen Young was in the Burt Reynolds movie Heat, which I actually just did a show on.
I have not seen Heat.
Oh, well, you should. They actually make a Burt Reynolds joke in the first few minutes of Deep in the Heart.
Oh, they do, don't they?
Remind yeah. Well, they're watching sort of a rehearsal of Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, and Kathleen's friend is trying to sort of get her to sort of loosen up and go on a date, you know, and meet some guys. And
yeah.
And she's trying to talk her into going to this party and said that, you know, there's going to be some people there, including Burt Reynolds, to try and get her excited. And then 2 years later, she's in Heat, where she steals the movie from Burt Reynolds. My yeah. listeners may know Karen Young best for her role as the FBI agent Robin San Severino on 10 episodes of The Sopranos. She's Adriana's handler when they're using her as an informant. And I was like, hey, it's Karen Young. She's on The Sopranos. Like, that's the kind of film nerd I am. But it's an incredible performance, an outstanding performance with a real transformation. It takes a long time for what happens, the horrible event that happens in this movie, to happen, which I presume is Garnett just trying to get us to like her and to try and understand her. Tell us what's going on in this movie.
Kathleen is a young teacher in the Dallas area, but she's from Boston and she's still new to the area. And her colleague and friend invites her to a barbecue at her house where she meets the antique gun nut lawyer. And also, he is like the textbook example of a mansplainer, you know, before that term existed. So you're like right away, like he's just really condescending and really, kind of has a sliminess to him, but he's a lawyer. So he's kind of like in this, he's kind of in like a nice clean package, but of course, it turns out to be quite the screen villain, and she, you know, they go out as she thinks of it, as friends, not really that interested in a relationship, but he has other ideas. So what ensues is a really, really uncomfortable, really not an easy scene to watch, but it's a pretty violent date rape by at gunpoint. I think it will still probably make quite a few surprise and or shock quite a few viewers just in terms of how you know, just how plainly it's depicted. But it's all, like I said, it's not, like you said, it's not done in an exploitative way, I don't think.
And not only that, but her assailant is a lawyer, and so he knows what he can get away with and what he can't get away with.
Right. He's a respected member of society. And
but he's even mansplaining things to her while it's happening, that he reminds her that he's acting within the boundaries of the law, that she accepted his invitation to come to his house.
Yeah.
There's another horrible scene before that where she's on her way over and he's sort of lathering deodorant and cologne on himself, walking around in the nude. And then he gets out either air freshener or Lysol to spruce up the area around the bed. Like he's
probably not the first time he's done this.
No. And, but he pulls out a handgun and he points out to her repeatedly that he's not pointing it at her. He's saying all these things that he can use to defend himself in court if she ever does anything about this.
He's memorializing all of these things.
He's reinforcing what's happening during the act so that if she's ever under oath, she has to admit that, you know, he did tell her that he wasn't pointing a gun at her, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's this ghastly post-coital scene. The movie fades to black. We don't see anything explicit in this film, but I felt sick watching it. And he tells her in later that night that it's all her fault because she's so beautiful. And then he starts lecturing her on how uptight she is sexually and says that, you know, you must have been traumatized at some point in your life. Pure projection. It sounds like he's talking about himself, but he's throwing it all on her. And it's so and more mansplaining, like you must've been traumatized at some point in your life. Yeah. Like half an hour ago.
He really is a detestable. He's a detestable character. There's no getting around it. So it makes the later part of the film, as the tables are turned, you know, all the more enjoyable because of how it's been set up. But yeah, at the same time, it's not like he's not a cartoon villain. He's not like one of these, you know, he's not like one of the villains out of, say, Sudden Impact, you know, which is the film that supposedly Warner Brothers, kind of buried deep in the heart to benefit, so that Sudden Impact would benefit.
Yes. Yeah. They Warner Brothers did that sort of what Miramax used to do, where they would buy movies to make sure that they didn't get seen.
Well, actually it's what studios did way back, you know, earlier in the 20th century, you know, buying up previous versions of films because they were going to remake the same property. And that's why films like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you know, with Frederick March and Miriam Hopkins, was buried for so many decades. Deep in the Heart was eventually found an American distributor, which was Warner Brothers. And since they had at least that's what Tony Garnett said in an interview, he believed that since they had another similarly themed film, you know, another Dirty Harry movie, which would have been Sudden Impact, that they held, you know, had a higher priority on, that's why Deep in the Heart was given, you know, such a a non-release in this country.
The thing about Karen Young being such a good actor is that her character is so sweet and wants to be to fit in. She's come from Massachusetts to teach school in Texas. She is so fresh-faced that at first I thought she was a student at the school. She seems like she might actually be going to the high school, but she's a teacher there.
I feel like there might even be a joke in the film even made to that, you know, to that effect.
She accidentally sets herself up for all this because, you know, he's conventionally attractive and she's, you know, she's trying to be nice because this is Texas after all. She invites the guy to talk about guns in her classroom, even and but and his lecture to the kids is so more mansplaining and condescension. And he's also flirting with one of the other girls in the classroom. And he's saying all these ghastly things about the conquest of the West and, you know, how great it is, might is right and stuff. And she's trying to sort of play along a little bit, like she's not horrified by him, but, you know, she has to put up with a lot of bullshit from him on their dates. Like they go to this nice restaurant and he starts ranting about social services and complaining about how in the last 10 years, there's been this tremendous buildup in government supported welfare type programs. It's contradictory to the frontier spirit. And she says, "You sound just like my father." And he says, "Wow, he sounds like a great guy." You know, like that's just like red flag after red flag with this guy.
Right.
She
right.
says, you know, "I had this domineering father," and he says, "Well, I would have been rough on you too if I was your father."
Yeah.
And can we also talk about that beautiful, weird scene where she gets a phone call from her mom and dad? That really felt like a Ken Loach kitchen sink moment to me.
Yes. Yes. And the actors playing the parents were, I believe, non-actors, and they were from Boston, and her character is supposed to be, of course, that's where her character is supposed to be from. Yeah, there's a sadness to that. There's a realness and a sort of a little bit of a sadness there. You really get the sense of, you know, that she's away from home and kind of isolated where she is in Texas.
Yeah. And that there's a sort of an emotional alienation even with her own family. Like she seems happy when they call her, like that she gets to talk to them, like she goes to go find a comfy place to sit. And while the mom's talking, the dad is just standing there. And I thought that he was going to tell her some bad news from the way his posture was. I just thought that he was waiting to tell her something terrible. But in fact, he just wanted to talk to her. It's just that it's fraught with some kind of miscommunication and then she try and get her dad to be happy to talk to her. She mentions that she's been going back to mass. She's a good Catholic girl. And he seems sort of happy to hear that. And then after they get off the phone, the mom and dad sort of just walk away from the phone. And we cut back to Kathleen, who just starts crying. It's this small little scene, but it just gives you an idea of just how lonely she is.
Yeah. And also, like, I don't know if we learn her exact age, her character's exact age, but she's pretty young. This could possibly be her first job out of school. She's really like on her own for the first time. She's really still trying to find herself and really has very, very little, you know, life experience. She's trying to find acceptance, try to find her people, and also she's trying to establish herself in her career. So it makes sense that this guy who's probably a few years older and he's a lawyer and he's established, you know, that she's being polite, maybe overly polite to him.
But he's sort of grooming her in a way too. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's taking advantage of her willingness to be nice.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. You know? Like that's why when you were describing how he was setting up his house before she comes over, yes, it feels like, okay, he's done this before. He's got a process here, and yes, it is a grooming process.
The reason why the sexual assault scene hits so hard is because we really like her, and we really we don't really like him very much, but we can't believe this is happening to her as much as she can't believe it's happening to her. She's always trying to be a good girl.
She didn't do anything wrong.
No, she didn't do anything wrong. But not only that, but all the things that she did to try and not do anything wrong are going to be used against her when she wants to do something about what happened to her. And that's another really strong stretch of the movie, is where she's getting nowhere. Mm-hmm. She immediately goes to what you're supposed to do, to go to the police after you've been assaulted. Mm-hmm. And at first, the cops are being semi-nice to her. Mm-hmm. And she goes to a rape crisis center and gets looked at. But then a little while later, she gets a haircut, a very, very brutal short hair. Mm-hmm. And she's now very different at school. She's very, very boxed in and very resentful. Mm-hmm. There's that great scene where she's showing the kids this film about the old West, and she just turns the projector off because it's reinforcing all this stuff about, you know, the conquest of the West. And she makes this sort of based speech to her kids about how America's frontier was decided by the winning side in a race war. she's become militant, mm-hmm. and she's erased all of her former feminine traits. Like, she used to wear, you know, long blonde hair. We're very aware of how long her hair is in this movie. And then suddenly it's cropped short, and she's telling all the kids in her class to get the gum out of their mouths and yelling at them about the true history of America. This is also heightened and sped up by this really unsatisfying experience that she has with the church, because she tries to talk to the priest at the Catholic church about what happened to her. Yeah. And he starts blaming her for what happened and telling her that this man, you don't have to go after this man because, you know, he's in trouble with God. Let God take care of it. Were you doing over there? Yeah, you should pray for him. You really feel for her. And then she basically snaps. You realize while you're watching this movie that in America, you know, this patriarchal system is set up to basically protect rapists, and women are supposed to know their place and they're supposed to feel that they asked for it. But when she becomes militant and decides to join a gun club, mm-hmm. and to take all the sort of rhetoric of life in Texas at face value, suddenly she's got lots of help. She's got all the help she needs, mm-hmm. once she joins a gun club.
Yeah, well, I wanted to just take a quick step back, because you mentioned when she cuts her hair and obviously how long and flowing it was before she cuts it. And the ad that Karen Young answered for the film in one of the, you know, in the backstage or one of the other trade papers at the time, I think they were looking for someone that looked Irish, you know, had that look, but also had to be willing to cut their hair. that's how the part was listed.
And I love hair cutting scenes in movies, because you only have one chance. There's a long take where her long locks are just shorn off, and it takes like a minute for the hairdresser to get through.
Well, something else I wanted to say, I don't know if you thought this, but I have a feeling this probably occurred to you also, but especially after watching this movie a few times and also taking lots of like screenshots and you know, working on the trailer and such and going through the footage, it occurred to me that how you described her snapping before and, you know, cutting the hair, and then the process that we then go into of her, you know, kind of getting indoctrinated into this gun culture and learning that craft. When I was watching it, it was reminding me of the transformation that we see in Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket a few years later with the D'Onofrio character.
Yes.
Where he is traumatized and isolated in the group. And then the way that then he sort of ends up excelling in the use of guns, and that sort of blank stare, like there are scenes of her on the gun range where, you know, as again, after she's cut her hair and she's just so laser focused, but mm-hmm. at the same time has that sort of, she has that look like where she's, you know, there's a light that's been lost. And it was reminding me of Private Pyle, the arc of his character, D'Onofrio's character, Vincent D'Onofrio's character in Full Metal Jacket. And I was thinking, I wonder, you know, if this was a movie, and I wouldn't be surprised, given the movie's British origins, if Kubrick had seen it, and if it was something that possibly, you know, fed into that portrayal in the film.
Well, another thing that I also noticed in the movie was, like, you know, this is why I prefer the title Deep in the Heart. Something about her has died, mm-hmm. from what happened.
Yeah.
You think about that moment where she's at the restaurant and the guy is telling her that she's really beautiful, and she's, you know, she is beautiful, and she's got this great gap tooth smile, and she's very sort of, she's blushing, and what he does to her is just so upsetting that one of the things that I found very moving was when she was at the gun store and was getting really excited about the various kinds of guns that she could purchase. Mm-hmm, and she's like, I love the feel of this one. I love whatever. It's like he took her away from herself by what he did to her. Like we don't know exactly what, I mean, we presume that she's going to take revenge on him. And she's also showing up at all of his locations, but it's kind of like, if you can't beat him, join him.
Yeah. He's in the gun club, the same one.
Yeah. And, but, you know, the only way that she can get any kind of revenge and to get her own back is to turn into a guy like him. Like, it's destroyed her on various levels, what happened mm-hmm. to her. Like, mm-hmm. she's no longer herself. She's now at home with, you know, her short hair, doing all these sort of military exercises and running around her house. There's that great shot where she just sends this lamp that's in her kitchen swinging, and she's, you know, taking target practice at it. And she goes to the gun range and does very well. Like, she's very good at this sort of gun competition, but then she intentionally shoots the target that's not that's a cop, because, you know, those spinning targets.
Right,
she empties the gun out on a police officer, and that disqualifies her.
Killed a friendly, as they say.
She learns the Mozambique drill, which has a gun maneuver that's been made famous in the works of Michael Mann. That's two in the chest, one in the head. Like, her whole mentality is now all about jargon and weaponry you know, weights of weapons. Like, she's a history teacher.
Yeah. 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 Did that remind you at all of the similar scenes in Full Metal Jacket?
Yeah, no, it's resonating with me. It also reminded me of Linda Hamilton in the Terminator movies too.
Oh, sure.
You know, she goes from being this sort of, you know, friendly waitress to being this survivalist, muscle bound, you know, no longer feminine, you know,
like, yes,
he violated her in such an extent that she, like, just abandons the person that she used to be and turns into a gun person. And to me, like, that's the really harsh critique. That might've been what upset that Amazon reviewer so much there are no resources for you. Unless
she has no other option. It's not just for revenge, it's for survival.
You know, this is a movie from 40 years ago, but it really does speak to today, as you mm-hmm. know, your company's statement is that, you know, these are movies that exist out of their time.
Yeah. I'm glad you're bringing that up and using it in that way. You're saying it better than I could. for sure.
But like that scene where she's at that restaurant and that sort of knife guy, she's so obsessed with weapons now that it's not just guns that she wants to buy. She wants to buy, like, hunting knives. And, she winds up with this sort of, like, proto QAnon guy who's ominously warning her that in the next 2 years, he even puts a number to it, when the government collapses and society unravels, that she's going to need to protect herself. Like, these people pay $8 a month for a Twitter blue check now.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
they used to be like weirdos in a restaurant, but now they're like a significant percentage of the population.
Yeah, or it's just it's just that now there's a forum. Now there's a forum that you know, everybody, where you don't have to be in Texas and meet the guy in a gun club. Now you just have to have a Twitter account.
Are you trying to kill someone out here today? Remember what I told you. Don't ever point it at anything you don't want to kill.
She plans it like a military exercise. Handgun. The story of an attack at gunpoint, which backfires. Handgun.
This movie is a very different kind of movie from your typical rape revenge film. This is a movie that actually denies you catharsis in a lot of ways. It's not I Spit on Your Grave. It's not Ms. 45. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I'd be interested to hear how you think this movie sort of detours away from these predictable directions.
Right. Well, I mean, when I'm on a podcast talking about a film like this and we're going so deep into it, and as you said, it's not it's not a film that a lot of people have seen. So I'm always sort of tiptoeing around, are we just kind of like going to reveal every plot point? Or
it's funny because, you know, this is a movie that almost nobody's seen. So I don't, but I would like to reserve the pleasures of the movie for people to discover.
I think it's, I will say this. I am satisfied with the ending, you know, in part because of the fact that it is counter to maybe the audience's expectations or, you know, what they've seen in other quote unquote rape revenge films, or just, you know, revenge films in general.
Not to give too much away from this movie, because I do want people to see it. I wouldn't call it a happy ending, but it doesn't pay off the way that you fear that it will.
Let me jump in. I'll tell you why I think it is actually kind of a happy ending, because in a way that is not a, you know, not a traditional happy ending per se. I mean, it's a little more subdued, but based on what you've been saying about how she's lost something, she has lost something, she's become hardened, and yet she's not given in completely into that whatever lack of humanity or what have you. Like she's not completely been lost to this darker side by how she chooses to, you know, resolve things.
Another thing about this movie where I'm just so impressed at the intelligence of Garnett was there's a sequence early on that feels sort of out of place where Larry, the lawyer, and his pals are, you know, having their bachelor party, and they wind up at a Foxy boxing tournament. Which feels a little out of place. Yeah, it's something out of Stripes. And at first I was like, oh, because I think Tony Garnett has said that there was some, that he did experience some minor sort of pushback, I guess, from his distributor about the movie. And I wondered whether or not they said, you got to have a scene at the Foxy boxing ring. But in a way, that sequence in a deft sort of shorthand way illustrates the entitlement of these men and the equation of sex and violence as well, and ownership, because this is what these guys do for fun.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it kind of shows just like it's boys will be boys. It's locker room talk, you know, it's roughhousing, good old boy behavior.
This is going to manifest itself later in her search for justice, where people are basically telling her boys will be boys. The police are telling her that.
Yeah.
The church is telling her that. Mm-hmm. And so she basically sublimates her own womanhood into becoming a violent man. That's sort of how I felt towards the end of the movie. Like she erases her former self. She is one of the boys, right? Boys will be boys. Maybe she can enact her revenge based on this implicit patriarchal bias that exists. And that's what I think is so funny about the unexpected ending is that, you know, it's, you're worried in a way that there's no turning back from this. Like I was, by the end of the movie, I was terrified that she was going to pay dearly for what has happened in terms of the act of revenge that she takes, that she'd be punished for it again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, without spoiling too much, she isn't exactly punished for it.
No. But I think knowing that, you know, Larry has been, you know, he's been beaten by a girl. Maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I imagine he's not going to try. He's not going to try again to do what he did to Kathleen and possibly other women before. You know, he proves to be pretty soft. You know, kind of a poser, and that's kind of what you know. What
all these guys are.
Right. I guess. But like somebody, you know, in particular, like somebody like him, who's privileged, who's, you know, he's upper class. And then in the situation where like the situation at the end where it's kind of real, he's totally ill-equipped, like, and he's basically, I mean, it's like a, you know, it's the classic bully, you know, once you actually punch back, you know, he just completely folds.
Yeah. So it's, you know, very clever movie. No wonder it made some people mad.
You know, it's like, I would say this about, other films that we've released that are in some part exploitation or in some part genre, but then in other ways, the movies do things that subvert that classification. And I think that, you know, this is obviously fits right in there. It does not do what people might expect and might be hoping for.
It's the kind of film that needs love, you know, like you guys do labors of love all the time, but there are also, I always think that there are movies that actually need love. And mm-hmm. This is one of them. Like, this is a movie that more people should know about. It's unfortunate that the climate in which it was released meant that it pretty much got suppressed in a corporate way. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful that it is finally seeing the light of day and being treated with the care and attention that it deserves. So I'm a bit of a fanboy for what you guys do.
Well, I never take that for granted, and I really appreciate that sentiment. And I'm so glad that that there are people like you that are, you know, totally on board and get the mission and are, you know, completely behind it. And, you know, one thing I will say, a silver lining for a movie like this, maybe being like a little bit buried or a little bit unknown over all these decades, is that I think because it hasn't been seen a lot, the things that it does are more, in some way, especially the things that it does that seem to look ahead or anticipate problems that we're experiencing now as a society, it resonates more, I think, because of the fact that we haven't been, it's not a movie that's been in constant rotation. So the things it does hit, it hits harder. It hits, I think, it feels like more revelatory, like I said, and more, it's something that's simultaneously old and fresh, if that makes sense.
Can you tell me a little bit about the transfer of this movie?
Oh yeah, there's actually some really good stories here, actually. I'm glad we're going to get to this. It's not a movie you can say is an American film, right? Because it's made in America, but it's made by a British filmmaker and a British film company, EMI. And now it's owned, the worldwide rights owner is a French company. So that's Studio Canal, like I said. So they own the film, right? But this is a situation where, you know, this is a film, it's part of a library, a catalog that's gone through multiple owners. Plus, as we mentioned, the film was distributed in the US originally by Warner Brothers, right? It's not like a movie where it's been made by a studio and that same studio still controls it. And it's always kind of like had this linear path. So all of that is to say that when a film has that more complex history, it can make finding the elements a little more difficult. And so Studio Canal, for instance, did not know where the original camera negative was for this film. And I have to give credit to a friend of ours, a friend of Fun City, Mark Hoik, who was doing some research for me for the film at the Academy Film Archive, you know, looking for like marketing materials and stuff. Because this is a movie that, as we said, had a very kind of aborted release in this country. So it's difficult to find original marketing materials and things like that we like to use in our packaging, as I'm sure you're aware. And he was going through the catalog at the Academy of what they held for this film. And lo and behold, the original camera negative for Handgun was in the Academy. Someone deposited it there. Not sure how it ended up there, but it did have Warner Brothers in the catalog entry. So, you know, through this convoluted process, we stumbled upon the original camera negative, which the rights holder didn't, you know, have a bead on. And so that's how we were able to restore the film, sort of, you know, finding without thinking we were going to find it there. You know, we stumbled upon the negative, and then Studio Canal oversaw and completed the restoration But again, I got to give a shout out to Mark Hoik, because he was the one who found it when all we were really looking for were like newspaper ads, you know, and possibly some poster art or something for the film. This film has been released on DVD before. I'm not sure what the source for those were, but I'm imagining that they did not go back to the original camera negative like we did here. So so it's going to look as good or better than it's ever looked before. And it was very exciting to find that out, because if we hadn't been able to find that negative, you know, then we might, you know, then you kind of have to go down the line of other elements, and you know, it could have been a case where we would have had to use a release print, which is not at all optimal. I don't, you know, you want a preprint element, and obviously you can't do better than the original camera negative. So that was a real nice happy accident, I guess.
Are you able to tell my listeners what's coming for Fun City Editions? Do you have any anything you can say publicly?
Sure. Things we've talked about a little bit. There's things that we've talked about, like Stranger's Kiss.
Yes. That's another movie I remember from video store shelves in the 80s.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like something that would be up Jesse's alley. it seems like something you would be into. It is it's Peter Coyote again.
And, so right there, I'm interested.
Yeah, and it's a really fun, it's really, like, I think for people that love movies about the process of making movies, inside Hollywood movies, movies that are really steeped in film history, like, this is one of those movies. And it would be a lot of fun to show it. And I've been trying to pitch, different theaters, different, you know, cinematechs, art houses, to kind of position the film with other films of that ilk, other films that are like set in Hollywood, you know, that show, you know, the making of a film and kind of go, you know, behind the curtain. And that's what this movie's about, because basically it's like, it's an imagining of what the making of Kubrick's Killer's Kiss was like. Like, it's completely, and it's not, nobody's playing Kubrick per se, although the director that Peter Coyote plays is named Stanley. But, you know, it's fiction. It's fictional. It's basically, that's like a jumping off point. But there are some fun parallels. It was the first English language film released by Orion Classics back in 1983, 84. It was released on video by, again, our friends Thorn EMI, HBO Video. So it was on cable. It played in, it was released in many territories throughout the world. And then, like, once all of those initial agreements lapsed, the movie kind of went into hibernation. You know, really officially has not been in circulation probably in, you know, 35 years. And the filmmakers went on to other things. And even though they had ownership of the film, they had lost track of where the elements were. And when I say elements, I mean like the preprint elements, the lab elements for the film. And part of that's because a lot of labs have closed over the last, you know, 40 years from when this movie was produced. So it's another example of, like, even though the movie's not that old, it easily can become lost to a degree, because the lab closes and then everything in it, unless somebody bought it and we don't know, like, probably got junked. So we don't have the original negative for Stranger's Kiss. But since the movie had been released at one time by Orion, I had a hunch that MGM might still hold elements, because MGM, you know, now owns Orion. So luckily they did, and we were able to work off of the best surviving element for Stranger's Kiss, which is in the internegative, 35 millimeter internegative. The internegative is what would have been the source for the theatrical release prints. And if we hadn't had the internegative, then there are a number of prints and we would have had to go off of a print. But again, obviously not ideal. So we the only release we've done that is from a print, release print, is Natural Enemies, because everything on that film was, you know, lost / destroyed, sadly.
Yeah.
So anyway, Stranger's Kiss, a similar story in a way, finding, you know, kind of doing, as I like to say, some detective work to find the best elements, and very, really very excited. The filmmakers are so excited about that. Then, of course, the aforementioned Seeing Red, the three French vigilante thrillers from the 80s. That's been dated. That's in replication right now. That is going to street on May 7th.
And where can people find these films to buy them? What's your preferred vendor?
Well, I mean, it really is just me, sell direct from Fun City Editions, which is to say out of my house, my apartment. So funcityeditions.com is a great place to find basically all of our current stock and everything upcoming we will always carry. But we're also available, you know, in any number of online shops, you know, from the big name ones to, you know, more, you know, mom and pop oriented ones, and maybe even in some brick and mortar stores. I'm always curious to hear, you know, if anyone sees them out in the wild, that's exciting. I don't see it that often. But sometimes it happens. But yeah, funcityeditions.com. You can be sure it'll be carefully packed, and you might get a little something extra in there. You know, I like to sometimes include little bonuses of you know, materials that we used in the packaging of the film, like lobby cards and, you know, novelizations and things like that. So you never know. You might get a little something extra if you order it from us, and you can be sure that it will be, you know, safely and securely packed. I do want to also encourage people to, we always like when people post pictures of their, you know, latest Fun City pickup as well. Something I'm always happy to like repost or put in the story. You know, just every little bit helps. Every little chance to spread the word a little further, spread the gospel, helps and is appreciated.
Well, Jonathan Hertzberg, this was a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for coming on. And also thank you so much for all the work that you guys do.
Thank you, Jesse. Thank you for, you know, for preaching on our behalf. And I know I'll be retweeting you in the very near future. And hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Patrons of this podcast help to make Junk Filter possible. To become a patron and to support the show directly, as well as to receive bonus episodes every month, please go to patreon.com/junkfilter. And please follow us on Twitter at junkfilterpod. We'll have another episode in the next few days. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Thank you so much for listening.